All right, the topic for this week is an easy topic because the name of the second portion is the portion of journeys. And everyone is on a journey. And there's so much to be gleaned, even from the pshat of the account as is written in the Torah. A lot of what I'll share is coming from the Alter Rebbe's Maimer. And I just want to do my best in expanding it to the best of my ability. So I'll begin with two stories. I know I have shared these stories in the past. You have a story where a follower of the Baal Shem Tov on departure was told by the holy Baal Shem Tov, who knew that he's going to be journeying near the location of his student who became his successor, who we call the Maggid of Mezrich. And the Baal Shem Tov wanted for this individual to send regards to the Maggid of Mezrich. I don't know the story behind that part of the story. This is a known story that many different Hasidic groups have. And at that time, the Maggid of Mezrich made a living by being a teacher for cheder kids, for young boys. And there wasn't a cheder the way we have today. There wasn't a building. The Malamed had their students gathered in their home. His name was Bedel, Rabber. And it took a while for him to find Bedel. He was very poor. He lived in a very unlivable part of town. Maybe the shliach did not imagine that someone would be able to live there. But when he found him, he walked into the home, and you know, the way the story describes it, that it was in a parcel of shetach of land in which it was always swampy, which means that the homes constantly were sinking into the ground, which means that when you walked into the home, the lintel was, you know, you needed to bend down to walk in there, and there was no furniture. So there was a stump of wood, and there was a plank of wood on top of it, a plywood as a table. Whoever was writing it was imagining, I don't know, whatever it was a lot beneath the average of how people got accustomed to living. And after him conveying the regards to the teacher, who became later the leader of the Hasidic movement, he somehow managed, directly, indirectly, to express his astonishment of, how do you live without furniture? Not good advice if you see someone in that situation to ask them how they do it. Normally it's not helpful. That's not the way one should be empathetic, by becoming curious, how do you survive? At least it could be done in a very unsensitive way. However, it was done the right way, the wrong way, the middle way. And the Maggid's response to him was, how can I live without furniture? Can you please tell me about your furniture? And he began to tell him, I have a table, I have a chair, I have a closet, I have this, I have that. And he tells me, I don't see any of them. Ah, at home, I have them at home. Now I'm traveling. So the Maggid told him, I also have it at home. And I'm also traveling, I'm on a journey. And during the journey, you don't have to schlep with you all that luggage. That's a very nice story to hear. It's good to hear it when I was young, it's good to hear it again when I'm not that young anymore. Because we like furniture, and there is a place in where furniture is actually important. And Chazal tell us that beautiful furniture is good for one's ability to understand. That means it isn't only about the pursuit of materialism, which is okay in moderation. Not okay. It's okay and the mitzvah in moderation. But one of the benefits of nice furniture is that it expands the mind of a person. On the other hand, furniture can bog you down. Imagine going on a trip and schlepping furniture. Did anyone here ever go on a plane without anything? You know how freeing that would have been? A machaya. In other words, there we also know that. And so that's one story, another story, a beautiful story. These are old Hasidic stories that are very meaningful. This story is a bit more elaborate. The Baal Shem Tov, prior to passing, said goodbye to the people around him. He was divinely inspired, which also means that he had foresight that we don't have for a purpose. And I want to speak about that. The yearning of knowing what will be and how that ruins people's lives. But we'll get there. But the Baal Shem Tov had that vision, and for those individuals at that time, what he did was, after saying goodbye to everyone individually, and we have records of it, it's beautiful. It's very warm. It's very heartwarming. The last thing he told them was a story. And what became clear by all of those present, that he was telling them their story of their life that did not yet happen. You have to be divinely inspired to share a story that included everyone around him, and they're getting it, even though they didn't understand it fully. But they're hearing how their lives will unfold. And those chevra, until the end of their life, whenever they met each other, they would ask each other, nu, where are you up to in the story? How nice is that, or how dangerous is that? And I want to get
to
that.
Isn't that robbing someone for sure?
Thank you. So I want to get to that. So first of all, this is a story, and everything has two sides. Okay, very good. Dangerous. Shkoyach. You're saying something different, but I'm seeing that. Very good. To some degree. So here's what happened. Many years later, the Baal Shem Tov passed away, the Maggid passed away, and this is already the third generation of the Hasidic movement, and all of the students of the Maggid who were not on the same page, thank God, they had different understandings of things, they made some sort of agreement amongst each other, not to compete, that every person is responsible for a certain region, to bring Hasidus, as they understood it, to the people in that location, which was Gevaldik. And then, part of our Hasidic history, a very large segment of Hasidic leaders decided, we are moving to the Holy Land. Moving to Eretz Yisrael now is the most amazing thing in the world, and for many people, the most challenging thing in the world. You have to see both sides of that. It was certainly a lot more challenging then. There was, by the laws of nature, there was no means of income. It wasn't a land that was built out the way we are lucky today. I'm not saying that everyone has it easy today. I know that some people have it amazing, like here. Some people have it difficult, like here. But moving to Eretz Yisrael demanded for there to be someone then in Russia, in Poland, in Ukraine, that would support the family moving there. That's the way it worked. And we made a koilel. I know that today the word koilel is used in the Haredi world to married couples in which the wife works to support the husband for him to learn. I don't know how the word koilel goes to that. I don't understand that. There is a reason. The word koilel means to include, inclusive. Koilel means a partnership, an incorporation. That's an accurate translation of koilel. The word koilel meant that there were hundreds of families, mamish, that moved to Israel. That's a lot of people. Thousands of people. Every family that moved had a family that stayed behind, that undertook to support them, for them to be able to do the mitzvah of settling Eretz Yisrael, which was a mitzvah since the beginning. It's called the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And they had a koilel. And there are so many amazing stories about the koilel. It was called Koilel Hasidim.
Hashem's army.
It's amazing, huh?
Yeah.
And let me just say, a stomach came to me. These fascinating stories I heard growing up. The leader of the settlers was Rab Menachem Mendel of Vitebsk, also known as Menachem Mendel Horodoker. One was his family name, was the name of the village that he lived in. People were given the names of their villages. It wouldn't work today. Everyone here is from LA, but it worked then. Well, yeah, a guy from Vitebsk, a guy from Lyozna, you know, and everyone had their. There was a lot of also nicknames based on their coloring, the yellow one, the red one. None of this was derogatory. It's very, I think, geschmack. When you read all these stories, how it makes them very human. And some of them were great people, partly because they remained human. So this Menachem Mendel Horodok led the Aliyah. It wasn't called Aliyah. It was called the expedition to settle, to fulfill the mitzvah of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael. And the monies that the people behind gathered, sending money today is amazing. You can send a wire. Receiving money is even better, I know that. But even the sending the money, you press a button. Sending money was dangerous. People would steal it. So they had to designate a trustworthy person or people. Once a year, that person would go from Russia or from Ukraine through Turkey. That's the way the routes would work. They would go by train or by buggy until the Mediterranean north, and then they would take a ship down to the south. The story goes is that Menachem Mendel of Hardaduk, who settled in Tveria, whose burial place you can see when you drive today on the highway. I know many people are familiar with Rabbi Meir Balanes, which is Gavaldik. You can also see, it's Gavaldik. It's like Gan Eden, both in Tveria. It's like the most beautiful city, Begashmias Uberuchnias. I don't know, all together. For people who don't, just on the side, for people who have a difficulty with the nervousness of Israelis, you go to the north, you go to Tveria, relative to the rest of Israel. I'm not talking about Yerushalayim, where most people are not Israelis. I'm talking about if you were to live in Israel and there's something that's not fitting, really try that. You go to the north, it's late. For Israel, it's late, but it's very calm. He ended up settling in Tveria, which by itself is beautiful. He describes how difficult it was for them integrating with the locals, the local Yidden. And he felt at home with the Sfardic community. That's what he wrote. And which is so true, that the most similar, Hasidim and Sfardim are very similar. Unlike the Ashkenazic world. And he mamash couldn't find himself. So he settled in a few places. When I say him, it means him and everyone else. They ultimately settled in Tveria, and he's interred there. And he used to have a minig every Friday afternoon. This is a mystical concept we're learning now, just a plug, Sefer Yetzirah, Shabbos afternoon, which is really captivating. So one of the secrets of Sefer Yetzirah is that reality is a composite of what he calls smoke, Ashan. Ashan is Oilam, right? Shana, Nefesh. Oilam means physical space. When we look out there, we right away, we see the six directions or the three dimensions. That is the easiest to actually pick up with our physical senses. Then we also are affected in time. We live in the dimension of time. Shana. And all of us are always, on some level, more than we think, measuring, let's say, the dimension of, you can call it spirituality, the dimension of good and evil, the dimension of, am I more connected? Is this connecting me more to, or is this disconnecting me more to? And we always have that thermometer on, mamish, just like time. Time is going, am I more connected? That's called Oilam Shana Nefesh, space, time, and soul. Nefesh means our constant living in the dimension of good and bad. Connected to God, disconnected from God, however you define that. There is no experience that we have that doesn't have all of the three components together. If someone were to only relate to the spatial reality, they're not in touch with reality. They are escaping reality. If someone were to only live in time reality, or only in spiritual reality, they're not, it's unhealthy. It's like closing your eyes. That's a whole big toy. That's a big yesoid in the Sefer Yetzirah. And all of that is connected to smoke, because the word smoke is Oilam Shana Nefesh. In the Torah you have that when God appeared to Moshe, there was the smoking of the Ketoras, there was the Kohen Gadol going within the smoke. And then, mystically, there is a certain meditation that is very much connected whenever you read stories of these Hasidic Rebbes smoking a pipe. I know everyone says, ah, they had who knows what drug in the pipe. Could be, I don't know. But it wasn't about the tobacco or the hashish, or could be, it was about the smoke. Is that they would smoke a pipe and they would affix their glaze on the smoke, and I don't know what that does when you do it the way they did it, but it took them somewhere. I don't think it took them away from, it took them closer to the emes. This Menachem Mendel of Hanadok had that minig. Every Friday afternoon, he would smoke his pipe. Whenever you read these stories, smoking a pipe meant that they would meditate on the smoke. The closest thing to that you have in Kabbalah is looking at the clouds. Same concept. Okay, stargazing, cloud gazing, smoke gazing. So one Friday afternoon, he was so into his smoke that he was in a trance. And Shabbos was coming, and people got nervous. Maybe he went too far, wherever it is that he went. And when he came back, he shared the following. This is just about the koilo, how it worked. He said that all of the prayers of the Jewish people go up to the heaven through the place of the Beis HaMikdash and through Hebron. But for them, for the prayers that are coming from the Jews that live outside the Holy Land, they can't just go to Yerushalayim. They're not pure. So they have to immerse themselves in a mikveh. And the Kinneret, which was where he was meditating, right in front of, he lived right in front of the Kinneret is the mikveh in which all of our prayers, you daven, goes into the Kinneret, lucky prayer, I would like to be in the Kinneret, they get to go to the Kinneret, and from there, I think they go to Yerushalayim, and then they go to the Shara Shamayim, for some reason, is Chevron, mamash by the place of the patriarchs and matriarchs. He says, the Kinneret is not so happy to be used to cleanse our prayers, because from the Kinneret's perspective, there's a lot of, I don't know, impurities, selfishness, ego, delusions, whatever. And it has to, he doesn't want to do it. But because of the merit of the tzedakah that Jews live in out of Israel, that they support the Jews that live in Israel, the Kinneret is accepting all of, he's toiveling all of our prayers. This is such a beautiful story. So Menachem Mendel HaRadok said that what he saw was that the shliach that already was in Turkey, it's a terrible story, was robbed and murdered for the money because they came with real money. And he was witnessing this happening. And he says the calamity is, first of all, a person got murdered. Then the calamity is, he says that all of the money was stolen. The money that people lived on, there was like mamish, no money. There's no way. That was their income. And then he says, Beruchnius, the Kinneret was saying, if we're not getting the tzedakah for the next year, all of the prayers that are coming over there from Russia and Ukraine, well, I'm not taking them. I want to tell you something. As I'm on the side, I heard these stories as a child. It's so good for children to hear these stories. I don't know why, but I'm telling you, it's gavul.
Where do you get all these stories? Is there like a...
You have here and there. You have Sipuri, you have the Baal Shem Tev, you have all of this train English.
Have a kid's book story?
Yeah, I'm sure they do.
Joyce.
I'm sure they do.
What's the benefit for a child to hear this story?
I'm getting off track, but I want to tell you what the Friedrich Rebbe said. One of the most powerful gifts that God gave us was our imagination. If the imagination is used for something inaccurate, sheker, we're contaminating the most pure, one of the purest, most subtlest faculties that God gave us. Everyone loves going into their imagination. Lahavdil, Disney, when I grew up it was Disney, whatever it is today, they feed your imagination. When you hear stories of the Torah, which includes stories of tzaddikim, being that it's emes, however it's emes, you're getting the benefit of, like, I don't know, it captivates these stories. I still have that in me, the captivation, and now the prayers go into the, and the Kinneret doesn't want it. And then you think, where is Yoshed? What did we do wrong? Because someone stole. So you're feeding something that should be fed with the right content.
It's like a magnet plate for little children. They're supposed to.
I think if they do it on their own, it's gavaldic. I think the danger, no matter what they do, but if they're being fed, and they're being fed something that's not truthful, or even worse, I think it does a lot of deep damage.
Yeah.
It imprints in the imagination. like when it comes to eating, like many people don't eat sugar, good for them. So if my body should be respected, what, my mind should be disrespected, my imagination? That's the beauty of all of these Sipuri Tzadikim. It's because we all know there's a miraculous. We know there's a miraculous. But put in the real miraculous. Not that we have to understand them. I think it's good to hear stories and to have questions on them. But anyways, coming back. So it was Gavaldik. So he says what he did was, when he was in his trance, is that he found a police officer in Turkey. He found an honest policeman. And he guided the policeman to find the ganav. How great is that? And beautiful. You have honest people. And that person found him. He says, the moment the man was found, he knew, that Menachem Mendel says, I knew I can go to Shabbos, because he knew that money is going to make its way to Israel. It won't be stolen. And that resolved, at least, he says, the tragedy that cannot be fixed. But at least that the Yidden that here won't lose the money, and the Ruchnius, and that the Kinneret will never have to have our davenings go through it. Yes.
Wouldn't there be at least a level of intent that the Kinneret, right?
How great is that?
That at least the Jewish intent of trying, it should have some merit. Meaning, whether the money makes it there or not.
I know that. It's outrageous. I'm with you. That's good. Don't answer that question. I think. Leave the question. That's the mice. So, how did I get off on this mice? Huh? I have no idea anymore. You see, I went on a journey.
Oh,
well. About the coil. So, what happened with the coil?
That was awesome.
Yeah. What happened later was that this developed. I'm trying to remember why I got into the coil. That about this journey that you need to have here, you need to have there. And they settled that ultimately, as this grew, you needed more supporters. So the Alter Rebbe, just to know what it means, there is an organization called Kollel Chabad. Today, primarily in Israel, and it's an organization that gives food primarily for people that need food. It's a huge soup kitchen. It's not one soup kitchen. I think it's like 400 soup kitchens. It might be the biggest. But this is going back to the Alter Rebbe, and the Rebbe supported it. The Rebbe spoke every year that we have to Lubavitch, but that was founded by the Alter Rebbe. This is, I know why he said the story. So anyway, that was Kollel Chasidim. Later, because of its size, not every faction, I cannot speak for other. I know that the Chabad, the Alter Rebbe's group, the Alter Rebbe stayed behind at the end. He made a unit. One of the things that he did was Kollel Chabad, to give continuity, but that giving continuity meant that more families were able to move. And that's why all of the letters, whoever learns Tanya, it's all about tzedakah. That was all for the Kollel Chabad. And everything is about tzedakah Eretz Yisrael. That's what he did. He advocated. Okay, so what happened was like this. He wanted to move to Israel. Why would he be the one staying behind? He was a follower of Menachem Mendel of Haradok, even though the Alter Rebbe.
Okay.
Even though his Rebbe was the Maggid. And after the Maggid passed away, he considered himself to be a follower of his son, Rav Avraham the Malach. And all of us have to know that there has to come a time where being a follower is a disease. Remember that. If it's done the wrong way. You have to at some point take responsibility for yourself. But when a person is younger, they need to have a Rebbe. In the way where I'm not turning right or left without the guidance. You need to have guidance from the outside. And he still felt that he needed to have a Rebbe, and he chose to have Menachem Mendel of Haradok to be his Rebbe. The Menachem Mendel of Haradok was his last Rebbe. And part of that would mean he has to go with him. Okay, the illness that I'm referring to is called discipleship. There's a name for it. People that forever have to be disciples. And of course, we all have to be disciples. God forbid to think we know it all. We don't. The older we get, hopefully, the more we know that we don't know. Discipleship, the wrong way, would mean that we renege, we give up our responsibility of making choices by giving it over to the other. And even when the other knows more, at some point, make the choice, even if it might not be the right choice, so to say, the right thing was that you made the choice. Like when Moshe told God, should I send spies, should I not send spies? And God told Moshe, you make that choice. In that area, him saying, I'm not doing anything without the other, always seeking the other's opinion. Tell me what to do. There was a good part of that, and there was it's a dysfunction. I'm sure.
Would anyone have done that though, if the Rebbe was sitting in 770 right now?
The Rebbe, like the Rebbe, I'm not going to say unique, because I know many people that are great people, but the Rebbe certainly was a great role model in not responding in any area where the Rebbe knew that that person has to take their own responsibility. Mm. I want to tell you that you would still ask. And I didn't have this age then. I'm sure that people that were older, after asking certain types of questions and never getting an answer,
right,
they finally figured out that this is not the type of question that one should ask the other, even if the other sees what you don't. This is something that part of your life is that you figure this out, even though you don't know how.
Isn't it a form of confidence also? Like, you have to have a certain level of confidence. You can't always be asking for someone's opinion. There has to be a certain point. You say, you know what, I've done the work, I'm okay, I can figure this out. And I think the Rebbe saying to someone, or whoever, like, you can figure this out, it's saying, I believe in you. You should have confidence within yourself, because if you don't have confidence, that's a very dangerous place to be also.
That's true. I'm just going beyond that. I think beyond that aside of confidence, people have to consciously learn how to live in doubt. How does that sound? That's a good header. That's so important in life. Versus, I need to know. My goal is to know. I know I won't know everything, but I always need to be in the know. And if I don't know something, I'm going to drive myself crazy because I don't know. No. If you're meant to know, it's going to come to you. I'm not saying that this should always be the attitude, but this attitude is missing a lot. And when you have a question in the journey of life as to go right or to go left, how convenient is it to know? Yeah, so if you're driving a car and you have a GPS, follow the GPS. I'm not saying to go into doubt. But in the real journey of life, sometimes we don't have a GPS. And a tzaddik might have. So in that area, even though in first of all, I agree with what you're saying. In addition, even in those areas where me not being able to make a choice is not coming in my lack of confidence, how would I know the future? I don't know. It's not upon me to know, but why not tap into the one who knows and get it better? The other, if the other is godly, they will know when to respond and when not to respond. And if they don't respond, then we don't know. And there is growth only happens in the I don't know. Once you know, you know. Real journeying maybe can only happen in I don't know. I don't know what's going to be. I don't even know if I'm making the right choice. How great is that? I know that the other side is also great. And the agony of doubt. Doubt for some people is very... people that are afflicted with the need of controlling, doubt, whew, is the antidote, is the bitter antidote, that you're not in control. You don't know. You don't know. Coming back over here. So the Alter Rebbe wanted to go with his Rebbe. At that time, he felt I needed Rebbe. And he went, and he was going on the trip, and they passed through the city of Pulna, in which Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Pulna, who was an elder then, compared to everyone else, he was from the older disciples of the Baal Shem Tov. Menachem Mendel of Haradok was probably the youngest one. They met each other. Knew, where are you up to in the story? So that was easy. So he told them, I'm on the way to settle in Israel. So he told them, and where is the young man whose Torah shines from one end to the world to the other? Where is he? Because when the Baal Shem Tov was telling the story, he mentioned that there'll be this young man whose Torah will shine throughout the world. So he pointed to the Alter Rebbe. And again, this you have in the Gemara what I'm saying now, that older people, men, don't get nervous, it's a man thing, Older people at times have their eyebrows grow so long that it covers their eyes. We know that Rabbi Yochanan, this is from the beginning of the era of the Talmud, had such eyebrows, and he left it that way at that age, not seeing. That means for him to see something, he needed to lift up an eyebrow. This Rabbi Yaakov Yosef of Polno, it's almost like choosing blindness the right way. So when he heard that the young man is there, he picked up the eyebrow just to see him, and he says, I want to talk to you. And what he convinced the Alter Rebbe was that you should not go to the Holy Land. You have to stay over here. And the Alter Rebbe turned back and he moved back to Liazna. And like I mentioned before, that there were other great tzaddikim. Each one was responsible for a certain region. All of them went. So the Alter Rebbe de facto became the Hasidic leader of the entire Russia and Ukraine. In addition to the fact, aside of the fact that in Halacha, the Alter Rebbe was the halachic authority in that region. He wrote a Shulchan Aruch, the Alter Rebbe, who's like the Alter Rebbe in Torah learning, but I'm talking about in Hasidic leadership. I shared this story to come back to the point, is that we all go through journeys in life. The 42 stops that happened when we were in the desert, they correspond to, the Baal Shem Tov said, every day's journey, every person's life's journey, and collectively, koilol, the Jewish person's history, beginning with leaving of Egypt, culminating in going into the Holy Land, both physically and spiritually, finally settling in the Promised Land. And if one would only understand the meaning, even of the names of the 42 journeys, it gives you a map of where you're at. And being that we purposefully don't fully understand the name, the meaning of these names, and I don't think we have a real understanding of where we're at, we don't know where we're at. But still, we can glean a lot without knowing from the 42 journeys. First of all, sometimes we went backwards, physically. In other words, we moved forward and then we moved back. Moving back, a life in which there is no moving back does not exist. Some people are not aware of it. How do they say in English? Upwards and onwards, onwards and upwards. Okay, externally it sounds wonderful. No doubt, part of life is part of onwards is backwards.
Even with the planets,
you have the retrogrades. When we go Shemoneh Esrei, we're walking to God. How do we walk to God? We walk backwards, we walk forwards. We don't just walk forwards. Not only for technical reasons, which could also be. No, it's good to understand that. Why am I saying that? Because everyone in their life will encounter moments in which they mamish are back to where they started. Be'emes, you didn't go back to where you started. It just feels that way. Even if physically you're back to where you started, the you is a different you. Every time we moved in the desert, we never were the ones that chose to go forward. We never did that. How amazing is that? And these are not just biblical stories. And also the way the Chumash describes that there was a cloud, the cloud would hover on top of the Mishkan. And then, mitamol, the cloud went up, not by us. And the cloud moved, and we followed the cloud. Now again, what I'm saying now, if it's misunderstood even to myself, it's dangerous. A big part of life, the big journeys of life, should not be with you sitting in the driver's seat. There should not be another person in the driver's seat as well. God should be in the driver's seat. And it's very tricky to get that right. The easiest way of getting that right is when reality changes against your will. That's for sure God directing me in a place where I would not have chosen, but it happened to me. How do I know it happened to me? If it's tangible, it's very, very clear. This is my next phase in life. I just shared such a beautiful story. In 2022, there was a terrible tragedy in August in Rav Shefa. I don't know if you know Rav Shefa in Yerushalayim. Right, you can see it. Everything now was during the week. There was a bus. Let's give everyone the benefit of the doubt. Let's say the driver lost control, whatever happened. An egged bus went in. It was out of control. It wasn't even going that quick, but it's a bus. And there was a woman, Shoshana Glustein, who was married. She was pregnant. She got killed. Two of her daughters with her. It was a tragedy. You go online, you'll see that. And there was a famous composer. Many of us know his songs. A composer of melodies. His name is Rabbi Hillel Pillai, or Pali. His name is spelled one way, pronounced another way. It sounds familiar. Huh? I just said that. It sounds familiar. Okay. My God. Okay. By the way. And he's special. You watch him. He's special. Edela scholar. He's a teacher. And that's a good. And he's also a music composer. So he married a son. He's probably in his 50s. He married his son. They were married weeks or months. They were in the beginning. And his daughter-in-law's name is Batsheva. And Batsheva got hit by that bus. August 2022. And they needed to amputate both of her legs. And whatever else, she was sedated for a long amount of time because they knew that she won't be able to take the pain. At some point when they brought her back, that was the first time, it was way after. I don't know if it was weeks or maybe even, I don't know what it was. Her husband was there. So first of all, she found out that she has no legs. And she looked at her husband, and this story was related by her father-in-law. This is a very powerful interaction. And she asked him, "Would you have married me?" And what do you answer to that?
I don't know.
You answer the truth. That's good. One thing is for sure, it's not what sounds better. And what he said was so beautiful. He says that when I was being, in Yiddish, Red Shaduchim, that's the way we talk, because we don't know anyone officially. So they bring you names.
R-E-A-D?
Yeah, Red. R-E-A-D. Yeah. But it's Yiddish. Yiddish. Same thing. It means when someone is suggesting a name, it's all other people suggesting a name, whether they know the couple, whether they don't know the couple, whether they... Red Shaduchim. He says, if they would have read the shidduch of a girl that's missing both of her legs, no, I wouldn't have dated you. But he says, that's irrelevant. We're married. This didn't happen to you. That's what he told her. This happened to us. And then they sat on that for a moment. And then this young man was so bothered by the doubt, by the question mark on their union, I mamash gavaldik what he told her. So he says that after such a question is asked, he says he wants to give her her wedding ring again. Because if you feel that you are a different person, okay, so let's get remarried right now. That's very powerful. Because that's the emes of our journey in life. Which is that we all have what we would have liked. And it's important to like, and it's important to make a plan, and it's important to envision and to manifest, and all the good desires, it's important. This is not taking any of that away. So we're not doing our responsibility. We have to chart, where am I going? When you ask a person where you're going, it would be good to have, at least in some areas, an answer. I think we should, at the same time, the real journey, the biblical journey that we undergo is dafka when we are being led by God's cloud. That means when life does not turn out the way we envision life will turn out. That's God's leading my life. And the only way I can fulfill whatever it is that Hashem wants from me in this place at this time is for me embracing with all of my heart that I am exactly where I'm meant to be. So it's easy when you read the story in the Chumash, even though it wasn't easy for them. Just we think it was easy for them. No, are you kidding? If God would pick up a cloud and he would take it from here and go there and he would put me over there, even though it's in the desert, I would know this is my place. But they didn't say that. They were constantly, where were they going? You think about it. Almost always. What were they saying the whole time?
Well, you brought us here just to kill us.
Let's go back to Egypt. Most of the time, they were not saying, let's go forward, even though it happened once. Which is what we do. What we do is that we live in the past. We live in what we would have wanted the present. We wanted that in the past. So we go back to the past. And how do we deal with the present? I wish it would have been X, Y, and Z. I wish it would have been X, Y, and Z is the greatest self-sabotage that we all engage in, all of us. And I don't even think we can get rid of that voice. We have to just know that this is a real, this is a part of us that does not have our best interests in mind, and it's not connected to God, and it's not the, not buttled to God. It's here to hurt us. It's the me that's hurting me. I wish it would have been. Everyone has that to some level and the other, and some people really live in that.
I think that's like the strongest Yitzhara. I really do.
Very good. That could be.
Living in the past of like
how
you think things, I think is a, again, maybe it's just me, but I think that's like the strong, just from what I hear, like from just the people in my life, like I really think that is such a strong Yitzhara that we have, unfortunately.
And
it's
that's
like acceptance.
Yeah, but so let's go into that. So how?
But a quick plug, because I don't feel like enough people say this. Everyone's like, oh, we have to be simcha. No, you have to sit and mourn the, wish it could have been. And people don't spend enough time mourning.
If you don't mourn it, I could tell you everything I've been through in my life, which in a million years, I was like, I cannot believe that I'm that person. I can't believe that happened to me. Like, I think the only reason that I've been able to take the next step is because I sit in my feels, right? Like, you have to sit and you do have to mourn. Because I think it's important to mourn, because once you mourn, then you can let go. Right. Like if you're
correct. Okay, so we'll say everyone's
how long do you mourn for?
Well, that's a good question.
Well, like, don't linear.
Don't put a time in that.
Yeah.
So I think these words were important to be added. So together with the importance of mourning, which is fine, at some point, whenever that point is, first understand that it's easy to say. Words are easy to say. The ideal would be to fully embrace what is. And make a new covenant. Renew your vows with a new present. Beautiful. That's really what we're telling God. We're in the 3 weeks. So we used to have a temple. I want to tell you that most people deal with the 3 weeks in a very dysfunctional way, which is we go back to what used to be. We go back what used to be. And we go to the morning. And I think halachically, of course, speak for myself, I fully accept the mourning that we have in Shulchan Aruch. Together with that, I would be dishonest to tell you that I'm in deep mourning for the Churban Beis HaMikdash organically. No, I'm in a different place. This is what is. Right. Not only this is what is, the only way forward is make a new covenant. Like, that's the whole Yom Kippur. Yom Kippur is basically, we let's go from our side. We did not live up to God's expectations. Let's say that that's the case. Let's go with that. Okay, so what am I going to do the whole year? Live in that guilt? No, I'm gonna do Yom Kippur. And during Yom Kippur, that's exactly what we tell God. We tell God, let's make a new covenant. You have these words in the prayer. Talave v'sra yosecha. We tell God. We ask of God that he should re-enliven your wife, us. V'tichras lo bris chadasha. We're telling God, give us a new covenant. We disappointed you. We made a golden calf. We were not loyal. Not to minimize that. Okay, now what? So we're missing legs, God. So you want to marry someone else? And at some point, God has to say, I'm going to renew my vows. Renewing my vows means fully accepting that I am at where God wants me to be. The reason why people have a hard time with that whether this is one's biggest Yetzer Hara or not. And you know, sometimes I'm talking to myself now, using the word Yetzer Hara is a cop-out, because it almost means that there is nothing I can do about it. There is something that I can do about it, and that is that the more that I appreciate the importance of living in doubt in the right setting, the more I appreciate the fact that I am not living my life on my terms. I'm not doing that. I aspire to live my life on God's terms, because it's God's life, and to do the best that I could in the place that He's putting me. I think the more we integrate these ideas, which are not that difficult to integrate, to really be makabel, because it's emes. When we do enough of that, even though the voice might always be there, but we can have a real, if we're not blended with the voice, if I understand it's a voice, it's not me, I have what to respond to it. I'm not saying that we always have to know the response, but there's a response. You're right, it would have been nice. And it would have been nice had it been different. I'm not, don't deny that. That's what you call mourning. I'm saying to give it its due. You're right. But I want to make a new covenant with the freaking emes. Because if not, I have this, not I have that. The first loss was not my choice. The second loss is my choice. Why would I hurt me? Let me do the best in the current. Until when God is going to lift a cloud and move me to the next place, which is another beautiful way of living. When I was sent to London in yeshiva in the 80s, the Rebbe at occasion would make a farbrengen. Some of the Rebbe's farbrengens were pre-known. Many times the Rebbe would just decide, just like that, to gather in New York time, it's 9:30 p.m. In England, London time, it was 1 or 2:30 a.m. That means that when you go to sleep at night, when I went to sleep at night, remember, we just got there. We took Air India. You should never know that. That was a good kapara with the smells. That was, whoo! I don't know if they still are alive. We went because that was the cheapest ticket. So we went Air India, and it was exhausting. It was overnight because it's even cheaper. I don't know whatever the logic was. So we got there, and we were tired, and this, and the first night we go to sleep, and the Rebbe's farbrengen. And we were the shluchim. We were like the older boys. And one guy says, if we're not waking up, there's no reason for us to be here. What kind of role model? The guilt. And your body is... So the way it used to work then, the technology that we had is that you phoned it in, and you would hear on loudspeakers, every little neighborhood had such a person. And in the bayas, and the yeshiva had it. So you had all of the local balabatim would wake up in the middle of the night. And so did the bachrim. And we were exhausted, so be it. We got out of bed and we went over there, and the Rebbe would finish the Farbrengen 6:30, 7:30 already a.m. Parenthetically, in the yeshiva in London, behind the yeshiva, there was a park, and in the park there were tennis courts. So there was a minig, not a good Hasidic minig, but I think a good healthy human minig, is that some of us would play tennis afterwards. But that was on the side. So that means when you go to sleep at night, you don't know whether you're sleeping through the night. I know for you mothers, as of course, you're looking at me like I'm crazy. But for me, as a yeshiva bachur, it was a beautiful thing. What you think you're planning out, your masuda, you're organized, right? You're going to go to sleep at this time. You're going to wake up that time. You make a plan, and you have to know deeply that that's just your plan. And who's going to triumph will always be God.
Get your brain to get there at that hour is a whole other exercise. You're like going to a different area of your mind that's like not there.
100%. Well, for some of us, the brain was never there. For some other of us, the brain was always there. But you're right. It's an altered state.
Yeah.
It's an altered state. There was a non-Lubavitch teacher that was just hired, a very scholarly Jew. He was so impressed with this. He says that means that the next morning, when you go to sleep, you might be woken up 2 a.m. Yeah. And then you have to pay attention for 4 or 5 hours. It wasn't so pasha to follow the Rebbe.
And this is a teaching, I'm sorry. Farbrengen is a teaching or like a suda?
So like this, the word Farbrengen is a generic word. It's used for many, most people have a farbringen. Farbringen is an informal get-together where the ideal is for people to be honest and open and share where they feel they are stuck, and have other people listen and encourage them or chastise them or whatever it is that is the right thing that needs to happen. And it's in an informal setting with a lot of food and drink.
That sounds amazing.
Okay, that's the...
Yeah.
Okay, that sounds amazing.
We're doing it now.
We do.
I feel
like
I should incorporate this more. I'll let you know.
The word farbrengen means to spend time together. And in yeshiva, where in some circles what is promoted is only learning, in Lubavitch we promote we have to have farbrengens. The challenge of a farbrengen is, if for a farbrengen to be real, first of all, you have to have the right people gathered together. It's not fair to expect of someone to open up and to share if, using today's words, if you're not safe, if you don't feel safe. You also need to have someone there that knows either that nothing needs to be done. Just someone sharing where they're at is in itself amazing, if it's properly received with people, and if there is something to be said, to be sure that it's coming from the right place. It used to be that farbrengens were very rough places to hang out in. I remember that, where people would pick on you. Great people coming from a good place, they would break you down. It happened to almost everyone of my age once or twice. And when it happened, oh, it really was very difficult. But there was a purpose for that, especially when we're younger.
Group intervention setting.
I would say that in the world that we live in, you will find God in the recovery community by far more than in any other community. Many times more than in a shul, sadly, but that's a fact. But a farbrengen that I went to, you have the same thing. You have emes, you have people sharing, people become vulnerable.
And that's such a beautiful concept.
Yeah, that began with the Baal Shem Tov. And the Litvish world were so critical of it because they found us to be what they call bittel Torah. And we never gave into that. There has to be this now. Everything has a dark side. The dark side is that it's not uncommon for people to make a l'chaim, which in moderation, that's part of our culture. Okay? Without moderation, it's horrible. Part of it is also for people to feel comfortable, especially when the other isn't such great other people that are going to protect your privacy. You have that also. You're going to share. Mesiras nefesh. I got to get it off my chest. Sometimes I know I'm smiling and I shouldn't be. You make a l'chaim. But that's a wise choice, but that's just a fact. So there is too much drinking, and what a farbrengen could turn into is that no one is really sharing anything. So don't call it a farbrengen. There's nothing wrong with socializing, people just getting together, people just making it, that's fine. But the purpose of a farbrengen, now let me go to the Rebbe. The Rebbe had a very unique farbrengen style, very unique. I'll share the best of my understanding of it. Externally, it simply felt like the Rebbe's teaching. It didn't feel like a farbrengen. The Rebbe sat in the head table. There were thousands of people in the 80s when I was there. The Rebbe would speak, let's say, an average of 45 minutes to an hour at a time in Yiddish. If you didn't understand Yiddish, they had these little radios and you had a one ear. Either you had, there was an English live translator, and you had a French and Hebrew. These were the three options in the 80s. And then between one talk and the other, they were singing, which was very inspiring. People would fill up little cups of wine. That ever was the one that insisted on moderation. So there was no vodka. There was horrible Kronheitz wine. Horrible. Poison. Ganellus was terrible.
Worse than the Fabrangian one that we have today.
Worse. and they would give you a little cup, little mamish, like dafka. And you would hold up your cup, and the Rebbe would make eye contact and wish you l'chaim, which was very nice. And sometimes he would ignore you, which was also important, but not nice. To add to that is that people constantly corresponded with the Rebbe, constantly, which was nice. That means even though that face to face, you didn't have that much opportunity. But people wrote, the Rebbe read everyone's letter. The Rebbe opened everyone's letter. They bought for the Rebbe a letter opener. And the Rebbe refused to use it. The Rebbe says that the letters that are written to me are sealed with tears and a machine won't pick up those tears. The Rebbe opened up the letters. Not always did he respond to it, but people were very honest with the Rebbe. And what the Rebbe did during the Fabrengen, and everyone has their story, mamish, you wrote something into him, there was something that he spoke that was, you knew it, even though he looked in one direction. I remember I was there for 10 years. The Rebbe didn't look around when he spoke. I don't think the Rebbe looked at him. He looked straight ahead, but you felt it, that the Rebbe is mamish. So you had that. So there was the pre-Fabrengen, you did your part. And remember once even hearing from my father was undergoing, I can only imagine whatever he was undergoing. He was so difficult for him that he flew to New York. He went to the oil of the previous Rebbe. My father was also there with the previous Rebbe. And he told the Friedrich Rebbe by his burial place that I heard from you that life is not that difficult. The Friedrich Rebbe once said in Yiddish, life is not that difficult. And my father told him, you did not tell me the truth. He was upset at him. You should have prepared me better. And the Rebbe in middle, and my father told me what he said before the Fabrengen. I don't know why, but he shared that with me, that I was like, I went there and I told him my mind. And the Rebbe, wow. The Rebbe was so good. The Rebbe had it. I don't know how he did it. He was chastising. There are those who say that life is difficult. That he began with that. And the Rebbe, the Shver, said that life is not so difficult. But there are many, and he mamish, he was speaking about what he was going
back.
He chastised my father that it's not so bad. It's taka not so good. But you're glad. But he you have to know how to say it,
yeah.
Because when we get it right, it helps. When we get it wrong, it hurts. Someone tells you, I can't take it. So you tell them, no, you could. Right? But then that smile. So that's cruel. On the other hand, just to have empathy. How are you helping that person? You are. But maybe they need something more than just hearing that it's that difficult. So there is that. First, you really have to validate.
You say it with love.
You validate, but after you validate, now if you're really a tzaddik, you have the right, because it's not personal, to really give it to the person. How dare, like, in the right way. And you feel it, like any good Fabrengen, like we were both on both ends of this. Hopefully. And if not, we will be on both ends of it. So I just want to come back to the journey. So what am I saying? I'm saying that there is, that living in doubt consciously, accepting that we are not in control, that we are not in control, and that Hashem is in control, not random, not the other person who might have done horrible things to you, and because of that person, and from some level, you find yourself in that predicament. Don't deny that, but that's not what's really happening is that God is putting you where you're meant to be. And after mourning properly, acknowledging that, to make a new covenant with the present, with the knowledge that you don't even know how long this present will last. By the way, you might be having a great moment when you're listening to this right now. Good for you. How long will it last? We don't know. Just like that, God will send someone to say this or not to say that, and all of a sudden you're going to find yourself back 5 steps, or in a new hell, I don't know, or in the opposite, anything. Understanding that in itself, that Hashem is the one that's taking me through my life. That we are, as a rule, we are not meant to know the 42 journeys, as a rule. And if someone does have the insight, that's something extraordinary. That we are actually blessed that we don't know. It's a bracha that. Either way, if something is bad, at least right now it's not bad. Unless people always think about the worst case scenario. Many people do that, so they're always living in the bed, just in case they're prepared. But even if something is good, enjoy it when it happens. Live now. And yes, and we have journeys and we have stages, and God is leading it. And some of them will be ahead, and some of them will apparently look like bechitzonius, only externally look like we're taking a step back, but it's not a step back because the you is always different. Even if you end up in the same place you were in the past, you are a new person. And in every phase, you have to make new vows. In every phase, you have to make a new covenant. And you have to accept that phase and give it your best and seek guidance and be very happy when you don't get the guidance that you're seeking. To get that balance well, this is the way that we go forward. We are certainly, as a people, we are in a strange place. Strange place meaning doesn't appear that it's that safe for us where we're at. From my perspective, there isn't clarity as to what the next step is. There isn't. And just to embrace, that's where we're at right now. What will be, we'll find out. Might be amazing. We should not deny the possibility of the opposite of that. That would be not responsible. And I think when we get that balance right, then we can tell God that wake up the heart of your spouse and give her a new covenant. It's beautiful words in the tefillah. And may her be precious in your eyes. That may we, the Jewish people, be precious in God's eyes in a revealed way. And Hashem should help us and protect us and lead us towards the redemption. Amen.